We often want to see things just from the adult perspective now that we're adults, but that child in us is still very alive, and those things get triggered. And then we have these big emotional reactions that are really inappropriate, right, to the workplace, and often really get in our way in terms of being effective.
Welcome to Mindful Warrior Radio, a podcast that explores the intersection of leadership, culture, performance, and flow. Through thought-provoking conversations with innovative changemakers and industry leaders, we uncover the mindsets, strategy, and experiences that drive personal and professional excellence. Each episode offers real-world insight, inspiring stories, and actionable wisdom to help you cultivate resilience, purpose, and peak performance in your own life. Today on Mindful Warrior Radio, we welcome our guest, Dr. Lisa Firestone. Dr. Firestone is a clinical psychologist, the director of research and education at the Glendon Association, a senior editor at psychalive.org, and the co-author of numerous articles and book chapters. Dr. Firestone is a national and international trainer and presenter on topics including couple relations, parenting, suicide, and violence prevention assessment and treatment. I'm honored to tap into the insight and wisdom of Dr. Lisa Firestone on today's episode of Mindful Warrior Radio. Lisa, thank you so much for returning to Mindful Warrior Radio. We had such a brilliant conversation when we first came together, and I'm just looking forward to having your wisdom and knowledge and insight back on Mindful Warrior Radio. So thank you so much for joining us.
Oh, thank you. Thanks for having me, Cammie. I enjoyed our conversation so much, and I look forward to this one.
Outstanding. I really would love to place our focus today on really trauma and triggers, emotional responses in the workplace, along with how do we navigate hard conversations and recover from hard conversations? How can past trauma influence an employee or a leader's automatic emotional and behavioral responses during work-related situations?
Right. So it's interesting because obviously the original traumas that we had did not happen at work, but they did happen with people in positions of authority a lot of times, our parents usually, and, interactions with people in the workplace that replicate those old feelings can bring up those old emotions. So when we have unresolved trauma, which we all probably do in one way or another, those things get triggered. Okay, so that's how I would define triggers, by the way, because why get really emotional as an adult about something almost like it's life and death, but things are rarely life and death in the workplace. We're rarely in physical danger, but what we feel, it feels like that. It feels that powerful. But when we're having that kind of big, powerful feeling in our adult lives, it's probably because it's some unresolved trauma. So I think that's the first thing for us to recognize. And if we can take a breath and kind of go, it feels like I'm going to die here, but I'm not going to die. There's nothing, this is not life-threatening. It can also get triggered for somebody in a position of authority, like a leader, because of their interactions with people when they were in the position of being more powerless. And again, starting from their childhoods. So it can bring back something. Those feelings can get stirred up on the other end. And now you're identifying with the person who was in power, but you're still having this big emotional reaction. So those unresolved traumas really do haunt us. And what I'm always saying to people is we need to identify them and resolve them. And then we can walk through them. But partly in order to identify them and resolve them, we have to be willing to feel about them. And people want to skip over that part. Like, who cares about my past? I want to know how to move forward. This is about work. This isn't about my childhood. Let's forget about it. But the reality is if we're having big, giant emotional reactions, it probably is about our childhood. because lots of things seem like life and death from a child's perspective. You know, your parent walks out of the room to get you a bottle as a baby, and they're doing a good job, right? They're trying to feed you. But that can feel like, oh my God, are they ever going to come back? You know, from a baby's perspective, until they have a repeated pattern of, oh, and then they come back with this nice, you know, warm bottle, experience, it can feel really threatening. And, you know, we often want to see things just from the adult perspective now that we're adults, but that child in us is still very alive, and those things get triggered. And then we have these big emotional reactions that are really inappropriate, right, to the workplace. And often really get in our way in terms of being effective in the workplace. Because if we're responding out of some old emotion, it doesn't really fit the situation. We're probably not even seeing it correctly. We may feel victimized by somebody, or we may feel like they're undermining us, or, you know, all these kinds of things. And that may or may not be what's going on. Because we're seeing it through the filter of everything that's happened to us so far in our life. They're also seeing it through everything, the filter of everything that's happened to them in their life. So it might look really different. Because a lot of times when there's a conflict, we want to figure out who's right and who's wrong. And it's rarely that simple.
Absolutely. So I think what's interesting is not seeing it correctly, right? So you're having this big emotional response, and perhaps you're seeing it from a different perspective or from a different lens. That's an old, unresolved trauma. And my thought and question is, how might an individual start identifying and or recognizing this emotional pattern that keeps reoccurring, perhaps in the workplace?
Right. I think there's a number of things. One is if you're having a big emotional reaction, put a question mark because it probably isn't about now, you know, because very few things in the workplace are that dramatic, you know? So it's really just important to try to hit the pause button and take a couple breaths and do something that helps you calm down. And generally, things that are rhythmical and predictable, like paying attention to your breathing. Or taking a walk, because you pick up one foot, you put down the other. You know, it's very predictable. That helps our brain calm down. So that can be helpful. Then it can be helpful to try to reflect on what is kind of the core feeling that's getting stirred up. You know, I think about it could be something like feeling disregarded. It could be something like feeling, you know, that we're seen as being, you know, childish, or we're being, you know, all, you know, these old feelings that are, you know, being dramatic. It could be anger. It could be all kinds of old strong feelings. But if you can identify the feeling and name it, that calms your brain down too. So if you notice over and over, think about past situations, maybe where this has come up. In situations that might even look quite different, you know, so it might have come up with a partner, might have come up with a friend. But if you look at what was the underlying feeling, it's often the same because that's the core feeling that we incorporated about ourselves early on. So, and if we can name it, it's like, oh, it's just that old thing again. A lot of the heat goes out of it, a lot of the intensity drains off. So just being able to name it helps. Even if we don't know, you know, that doesn't have to do with getting into all the specifics of what happened to us. It's just, oh, what is that feeling? And if you look at a list, there's a list from a book called Hold Me Tight by a emotionally focused therapist, Sue Johnson. It's actually about the demon conversation we have with our partner over and over, it doesn't get resolved and where there's lots of emotion. And she looks for that underlying feeling. Because this is the same thing as what we're seeing in the workplace. What is this dramatic thing? And when we can identify the feeling, and the more specific we are in naming it, and this is where I think males in our society are at a disadvantage because, at least as women, we growing up culturally are allowed to have our feelings. But men, by the time they're 5, are told, don't cry. You know, big boys don't do that. And so naming emotions are really sitting with them or paying attention to them, it's not a skill that a lot of men have developed. And through no fault of their own, you know, through the patriarchy that we all live with, we rob men of their feelings. We say women have feelings, men have logic. Well, obviously, we all have both. But, so it's really important, though, to sort of look at those things. And the more specifically we can name them, so expanding our emotional vocabulary can help. You know, I think about little kids, they call each other jerks, or something like that. We say, well, what do you mean? It's hard for them to elaborate on what it is that they're frustrated about or what it is that, and to really try to look at that and get specific about what the emotion is. And the more we can name it accurately, the more it calms us down. So that's a really helpful thing.
Yes. And I think one of the things that I'm hearing you saying is if you can name the underlying feeling, that the heat kind of comes out of it. I'm curious of if you have any thoughts or experience around what happens when you can identify it, name it for yourself, allow it to kind of not be as potent or powerful as it once was. But what is it actually to even share that information with a trusted other, to first identify, then acknowledge with yourself and name it? And then what happens when you can actually have a trusted other, whether it be your partner that you can trust or a friend that you can trust, or even in the workspace, whether it be a peer or a manager or a mentor within the workspace, and say, this is what I'm noticing continues to come up and is the underlining feeling. I'm feeling disregarded in meetings when I'm cut off in communication. And I can tell it triggers something, a big emotion inside of me. And I just wanted to share that. Is there any sort of data or experience around what happens when you actually can share that experience with someone else?
When it's a caring other, like your partner, who it really helps them to know you on a deeper level. And then they can recognize too, when they do things, oh, that person, you got really upset, they might say to you, oh, is that disregarded thing again? and that can be really helpful. But I think it has to be with somebody you trust, because that's a lot of emotional vulnerability to ask of somebody, especially with somebody who might be in a position of power in relation to them, like, a boss or a supervisor or something like that. So I think that's a little bit harder. But if, like, let's say your partner in the business, you might talk to them about it, because again, somebody who's more on your level, that can be a little easier. Or a coworker, I know I get triggered when I feel disregarded. And then they can also be helpful to you next time you're, oh, I can't believe they did that to me. You go, oh, are you feeling disregarded again? and not to make light of it, because it isn't light, whatever that came from is a real thing that happened. That probably deserved that heat, maybe, but not what's happening now, probably doesn't. And once you sort of take the heat out of it, then you can look at it more objectively, like what's really going on here? And what could I do differently? And sometimes you can kind of come up with an image of it. So for that disregarded or shamed feeling might be, the idea of, dogs are very sensitive in their noses. You hit a dog on the nose, they feel shamed. Not a good training idea because they just shut down, right? But that sort of can be the feeling you have. And if you can give that image to it, then it's like, oh, that's that thing. But that isn't actually really happening right now. Then you can sort of look at it. And so I think that's a really helpful way. When you're having strong emotions that are getting in the way of you even approaching conflicts at work, you can try to sit with those feelings and look at what they might have to do with from the past. Realize they're there. You can't just wish them away. Sort of sit with them and go, oh, what might this have to do with the past? And also not over-identify with it, because any experience that happened to you does shape how you see the world. It informs who you are, but it doesn't define who you are. No one thing defines who you are, right? We're just a lot more complex than that. So, it's important to look at it, but also not get too caught up in it and it defining us. I'm always disregarded. No, you're not always disregarded. Sometimes you were, and sometimes you were in ways that really hurt. But, in the current situation, you have a voice, you have the ability to decide whether you want this job, whether you want this position. You have all kinds of personal power as an adult that you didn't have as a kid. And it's important to recognize that too, that you're not still that child, you're an adult. And, it may not be in an ideal situation, but You have power and you can influence.
Yeah, I think that reminding and lifting up the personal power that we each hold as an adult and the old perhaps programming or protective mechanisms that we've put in place or have learned to put in place as children that follow us, you know, into the adult world that we live in now. And I think that personal power is such a great reminder that there's so much choice in how you're showing up and what decisions you want to make based off of your experiences. And the idea of sitting with the emotion for a moment, the great analogy that comes to mind when you say that is our emotions are like weather patterns, right? It might be storming really heavy over us in that heated moment, but eventually it moves through and the blue sky will return again. And so what is the amount of time or pause or moment or kind of internal coaching to self of, okay, let me name, identify, maybe ask myself, where's this coming from? What is this all about? And is it true? Is it true in the context of where I'm sitting today from this seat? And do I want to give myself a moment to let the weather pattern move over before re-engaging in the conversation or the situation or the environment?
Right, right. And I think that giving ourselves a moment and giving other people a moment is really important. And so many people don't want to do that. They need to work it out right now. But, you know, giving ourselves a moment really does let the weather pattern pass, especially if we're willing to sit with it. If we're trying not to have it, then it gets stuck. You know, but if we can sit with it, it will move through us, you know, and just allow it to be because we don't really have a choice at that moment. But we can do things that are going to help us get centered again, like take a walk, like sit and pay attention to our breathing, you know, maybe go into a different room and just breathe for a minute. You know, it's just really important. If we can do that, we can come back and be a much more reasonable person in the conversation. This even a difficult conversation that has to happen in the workplace. So the practice I like is an old Buddhist practice is called RAIN. So recognize what you're feeling. That's that name it to tame it idea. Then allow it to be, acknowledge it, and accept it because it is what is, whether you don't have a choice. But realize it too will pass, like everything else, right? And then the I is kind of like investigate, like what might this have to do with my past? Any sensations, images, feelings, and thoughts that come up as you kind of sit with that feeling. And then the N is don't over-identify with it, non-identification. You're not that thing. You're not a helpless child. You're not a, you know, angry person. If you're angry in a moment, you know, yeah, you were angry in a moment and we all, that's natural human emotion to frustration. But that doesn't mean you're an angry person all the time, you know, or you've maybe even had some trauma or really terrible things that happened to you as a kid, but that's not all of who you are. It's part of who you are. And, you know, just recognizing that and being able to let it go. And, you know, it's important that kind of go through that process. And that might take a minute. And, you know, I'm always saying to people, let the other person have their minute if they need it. Take a minute if you need it to step away from a conversation and be able to come back to it in a much more constructive way.
What might you share with an individual that might be held in a meeting that may have been triggered in a meeting and might not be appropriate, or they may not have the luxury to exit the room to have a moment? And so, you know, some examples would be the individual may shut down, they may disconnect, they may kind of glaze over in the meeting, and it almost starts to feel like it is a lost opportunity for them to provide their value and receive the value of that meeting. What might you share to someone who is, you know, not in a position to take that walk down the hall, to get a glass of water, to take a step outside and take in the fresh air, and are kind of like held in that moment with that trigger and that hot emotion that has arisen?
Really helpful if they can identify it. Okay, so what is going on in my head right now, you know? And maybe take some deep breaths. That we can do without anybody paying attention to it. And one breathing pattern that can be especially helpful is 4-7-8 breathing. where you breathe in for a count of four, you hold it for a count of seven, and breathe out for a count of eight. If you do that five times in a row, it will release serotonin in your brain, your natural serotonin, which calms everything down. And that's what you're trying to do, because to be present, you got to get your brain back, you know, calm. When we've, quote, flipped our lid, when our higher functions of our brain are offline because we've been triggered, we're not going to make good decisions. We're not going to be able to have great interactions. And that's when bad behavior happens towards others. It happens towards ourselves. We got to get that lid back on. We want the full ability of our cortex online. And to do that, taking some deep breaths can help. Doing maybe the 4-7-8 breathing if you can. Nobody has to know you're doing it. You don't have to announce it. These are breaks you can give yourself without having to make a situation even of saying, you know, I need to use the restroom or whatever, which you can also do if you absolutely need to, just to take a minute to breathe. And, you know, what are people going to say? No. You know? I mean, it's unfortunate because then you miss a little bit of what's going on or whatever, but it might be worth it if you're not really present anyways to take that, you know, that break. But if you can do it by just breathing, then you're still in the room, you know, nobody, you're not disengaged exactly. You're just paying attention to your breath. And, you know, it's just really helpful. It's part of what helps us calm down.
Yeah, absolutely. So identifying the emotion, just allowing space for it, and then inviting the 4-7-8 breathing pattern to help release that serotonin that calms down the system so you can re-enter into your body and into the
right.
present moment and have that ability to be present for what is left of the meeting or the conversation if you really feel right. that you're tied to being within that room for that period of time.
Right. Because sometimes you kind of are.
So I want to ask, because sometimes we have to walk into situations that feel that might put us in a more elevated state. So let's just talk about what happens when you're going into a meeting in which you know you're going to be receiving feedback on your performance, or if you know that you're going into a challenging conversation where you have to either deliver or receive some hard information, whether that might be letting someone go or, really challenging someone to elevate their current performance. There are times in the workplace where we know we're heading into a challenging conversation with others. Can you share a little bit about one, what someone might feel going into that if it's not feeling, and I'm going to use my air quotes, quote unquote, safe, right? It's not feeling safe, or they're anticipating some looming challenge, or something may horribly go wrong, or, you know, just that heightened anxiety going into a conversation. Can you explain a little bit about what happens to the body and mind when individuals go into that? And then we can talk a little bit about how, as the giver of the hard conversation, we can signal safety.
Right, right. So yeah, I think when we're feeling dread about a conversation, it may be that we're in a role we're uncomfortable with. And I think this is where women suffer from the patriarchy too, which is that, you know, being in a position of power or authority, especially over male colleagues, is challenging. If that's not the kind of world you grew up in, you know, where women were able to have a full voice or considered to potentially be intelligent and logical about things. And so it can be challenging. So you may feel like, oh, I have this information that I've got to deliver to this person. They're not going to want to hear. And they're, you know, am I any person to be able to do this? And, you know, that's where you have to own your own adult power. And yes, I can do this. And yes, I do, you know, need these things to change. But this is going to be hard for me. So it's partly challenge, you know, it's often a challenge to ourselves sometimes, even if the other person ends up not being disagreeable. But also, if we're going to give hard feedback, often people do get defensive, and especially if we start with accusations. So one thing that can be really helpful is, first of all, get yourself in a calm place so you've got your full lid on, because you need all your brain functions going on. So maybe meditate for a few minutes before you go into the conversation. You know, try to think about the bigger picture of things, and really have a clear idea of what it is you need to communicate. That's going to be helpful. And, if you're challenging somebody's performance, know exactly what you're challenging and what you want to convey that's going to help motivate them to be more productive, right? You don't, it's not just a matter of providing the criticism, what we really want the outcome to be. So I always ask people when they're going into those conversations, what is the outcome you want? What is it you're trying to achieve here? And it's really important to keep that center of mind because we can get lost in the weeds, especially if the person challenges us. And then we can get, into arguing back. And that's usually not going to motivate the person in the end to do what we want them to do. So that's not helpful. So what is our ultimate goal? And looking at where the two of us might have some shared ground. Like we both want the company to succeed. We both want this person to succeed even, but we need them to start doing something a bit differently. So how can we challenge them to do something differently in a way that makes them actually want to do it? And there's a group that does research on what they call self-determination theory. And what, it helps if the person feels like it's their idea. It helps if they get some feedback that they're confident at this new thing that you're asking them to do, and if they can have a sense of sharing it with others. So this is how we're going to work together to make something happen is more motivating than this is what I need you to do differently because you're the problem. If you go at something, if you can come up with those shared goals of what we both need to see happen, then it signals more safety to the person. They're more likely to hear what you actually are saying, and they're more motivated to likely want to do it. And when you criticize people, that does not motivate them to do things. I mean, we've known for a long time that punishment doesn't work nearly as well as reward, but yet we still want to resort to that, when we're frustrated with people. And it just doesn't work nearly as well. And if you can help the person come to why it would be a good idea for them to do this thing that they're really good at and do more of that, even if it means taking a bit of a pay cut or it means having to change something about what they're doing, they're going to be more open to it because they're going to be intrinsically motivated to want to do it. And that's really, really important.
Absolutely. And I think, we had a discussion earlier on about the difference between influence versus manipulation. And what I'm really hearing in how do you set as the giver of challenging feedback, right? How do you set yourself up for success? And what I'm hearing is as an influencer, having that common ground, talking about what is the outcome that you would like to see? What would you like to achieve, not only for this individual, but together? And what are you guys holding? What is the larger vision outside of getting in the weeds of this is not being done correctly? That's not what you're supposed to do. You're not supposed to, like the expansion of when you can tell someone what direction to go rather than what not to do. And so what I'm hearing there is there's a true kind of coaching and championing spirit behind that and some inspiration of bringing someone to, identifying their competency or strengths or skill sets or ability in the direction in which they're looking to go, and or maybe shifting the direction to ensure that they're staying in their strengths, skills, and abilities of what's possible, right? And getting that buy-in. So I think there's such a difference between that influence and manipulation, right? And there's a little bit of that at play in this conversation. Do you want to kind of share and identify the difference between those two?
I think that, influence is motivating. And you want the person to be motivated, right? You're going to get a better performance out of anybody if they're motivated. And what motivates people is feeling like they have some choice in it, it's hard for people because sometimes they want to think, oh, I'm good at this, but I'm going to work up to being the manager and I'm going to blah, blah, blah. And maybe manager is not their strength. Maybe, salesperson is their strength and that's where they shine or they're, and it's sometimes hard for people to feel okay about that, there's a certain steps that they had in their mind, but helping them feel motivated to do the thing they're really good at and say, in this situation, in that situation, you did a really good job. It turns out stressing when they did a good job means they're more likely to be motivated than saying, oh, but you failed here and you failed there. And it may true, both may be true, right? But it's where you put your focus, you know? And so really helping and somebody identify where their strengths are and acknowledging those makes people feel more motivated. So that's influencing. If you're, you know, trying to manipulate, you're often making the other person feel small in some way and like they have to bend to your will. And you might even get them to do what you want temporarily, but they're not going to do it with any loyalty or any self-motivation. So it turns out that even if you tell children what game to play, they don't want to play it anymore, even if it's their favorite game that they used to love. But if you let them choose it, they really want to do it. So it's really, you know, it's this fine line of, you know, influencing them, but not trying to micromanage them, control them, focus on the negative. You have to do it. Once something becomes a have to, we don't want to do it. Mm-hmm. You know, we were loving doing that same thing, but when we have to do it, it's not fun anymore. You know, you were an eminent athlete. You know that, you know, it's got to be your motivation, right? If it was your parents saying, we want you to be this, you'd be like, you'd lose interest pretty quick.
Yes.
It doesn't work in the long run. And I think as a parent, it's, you know, helpful to expose kids to lots of different things, but find a thing they love and that they're actually good at. Don't tell them they're good at things they're not good at. It doesn't work. Because eventually in the situation, they get feedback that they're not great at it. But it's important to try to find something that they are good at and they really like. And that's what you want to do with the people you're trying to influence who are working for you, is find things they're really good at and really support them in doing those things, you know? And maybe they can develop new skills. I'm not saying people can't. And if they want to, great. And maybe they would take this extra class or do this extra activity or whatever. I'm not saying don't encourage people to expand their abilities, but it really helps to focus in on what do they enjoy doing and what do they do well and how can we reinforce that. And if we can do that, we're more influential. If we're trying to manipulate, we breed a lot of resentment in eventually. And if people feel like everything is being directed by somebody else, then they lose interest. And it's not that everybody, you know, needs to have as much input as everybody else, but letting them have input or control even over their small part of it makes them more want to stay. So if you look at jobs with lots of turnover, there's usually, you know, you have to do it exactly like this over and over and over again. And, you know, people don't love that after a while. And they don't stick to the script anyway, so it doesn't work. You know, you want them to, but it doesn't work, you know, because they just don't. They make it their own.
You've given some really great tools and skill sets for leadership coming in and having those challenging conversations. Like, how do you bring in space and individuality? How do you highlight certain strengths that are at play? How do you give choice within the conversation? And also, what is really kind of the highlighting differences between influence and manipulation? I'm curious of, just because I think it's important for our listeners to hear, is what is the experience if we do not have a skillful leader who mm-hmm. is communicating in a way that signals and creates safety? What can be the experience of the one who is receiving that feedback or receiving the other end of that challenging conversation? Because I think when we paint that picture, we can, as leaders, be more motivated to become skillful, to be more intentional about coming in, to be more, as you said, taking a moment to meditate or taking a moment to write down your talk track or those kind of, what is the outcome that we want? Is that that higher level? And so when we recognize actually what is the cost of coming in without those skills in place, perhaps we'll be more motivated to kind of think about that. So what is the experience of the receiver in a conversation that's not held really with that level of safety or skill set?
Yeah. I mean, well, first of all, if we come in on the attack or criticizing, people get defensive. It's automatic. And, you know, even if they agree with you, they're going to defend. the behavior, even if they know on some level you're right. Like they do take, 2 hour lunches, and they know that, you're not just making something up. They're still going to be defensive, so it's not helpful. And so it's what they do is they get defensive, they get angry. So you notice their temperature rising, okay? And that's often a trigger for the person who's trying to have the conversation, which means, we have to be more forceful and we have to really, get into it. And then things just escalate and go sideways. The person gets angry, they feel resentful. Or you may have somebody that when they get challenged, they go more into, shutting down. So all of a sudden their posture may be looking down. That shows you they're feeling shame. And if you notice that in a meeting, you go, okay, I wasn't trying to trigger shame. That's probably not what you're trying to inspire, but that's what people feel. And they look down and they have that hunched posture. So, how do I get them back into the room at that point? Because now I'm on a track where they're not yelling at me, which, that's easier to see and that's easier to send us more into the, anger zone too. But, they're shutting down, they're not speaking, they're not engaged, they're probably not really hearing what we want to say, what we're saying anyways. So they're not getting the message, whatever it is we're trying to deliver. They're in retreat mode. And with difficult conversations, there's usually people want to have somebody be the good person, the who's right and who's wrong, the good person, the bad person. And at that point, you're the bad person, and the person's feeling shut down. And that's not helpful. It's not motivating. They're not hearing what you're saying. They're not going to engage more. And they're going to be really not motivated and feel adverse to coming or even showing up in the workplace. Because it feels like a place that they feel shame, So helping them see, and so I think it helps to set the thing of, okay, we're working together. How do we make this work? I mean, unless you're ready to really see the person go and you're ready to give up whatever they're contributing, you want them to be engaged. You want them to hear your feedback. You want them to take that next challenge that you're trying to get them to do. You still might want them to take a shorter, lunch, not 2 hours. But, how can you talk to them about that in a way that's without shaming them or shutting them down? Or maybe even trying to understand why they have a difficulty staying in their seat, which might be that they need to get up and walk around every half hour to be more focused. But you could have that conversation. If you come at it with, you do this and it's terrible and it's destroying they're not going to hear you. But if you do it with, hey, one thing I've noticed is this, and I'm trying to understand what's going on for you. And, that can be really helpful.
Yeah, what I'm hearing a little bit is this approach of kind of setting some high level boundaries as you're going in. So what I'm hearing is putting some just really helpful, collaborative and shared goal information in the front of the conversation before you have to deliver the challenging feedback. And I'm also hearing a great deal of curiosity. Right. So, can we ask a question? Can we invite curiosity in to hear perhaps the individual that may potentially move into being defensive and/or protective or might shut down? So, how do we actually invite that person into the conversation and have them leaning in? And so, kind of framing the conversation and setting some boundaries or expectations in a welcoming and safe manner, then curiosity, what are you experiencing here? Where maybe your challenges are? Where do you feel you're getting stuck? Is there even any sort of awareness of that individual, of the behavior that maybe starting to perpetuate that's not impacting their performance in an appropriate way? They may be able to deliver that outcome for you without you even having to say it. And then you can come alongside of that individual, and then be able to have these kind of shared agreements of how you want to move forward rather than telling someone, and wringing that motivation or that ownership or choice or agency of themselves out of the opportunity.
I think that's really helpful because when the person can say it themselves, the exact same thing, you can then say, oh, yeah, I have noticed that. What could we do differently to make that work better? And people are not defensive when people can own a lot more about their own behavior when they're taking a kind attitude toward themselves. So you want to start with creating that sense of safety. That makes us all more reasonable. When we feel safe, we can speculate about even some of our weaknesses. But when we don't feel safe, we have to try to present this really good front, and we get much more defensive. So if we can open up the conversation in that way, think about our larger goal and how we might get there with this person, and take everything you know about that person. Now, you don't always know your employees super well, but sometimes you do know some of their rough spots. And you can take into account, oh, this is a person who struggles with this, and I know this is where their buttons are. When I've had tried to have these kind of conversations with them and brought this up before, hasn't gone well. How could I do it differently? That might actually get a good response from them. And if they feel like I'm being a team player, I'm going to get a lot more playing. It's going to go a lot better than if they feel like I'm putting them in the penalty box. That just makes people not happy, right? So you want to sort of draw that out of people if you can. And if you create that safety, they can self-own more. And you can also clearly state what your, you want a lot of curiosity and get their perspective first, because you'll learn a lot. And maybe you'll even understand something you didn't understand. Maybe they've got a health problem they haven't told you about, or maybe they've got stresses that are going on at home or whatever. But then you can understand more, right? And you're going to come at it differently. But then, it doesn't mean because they have childcare problems, you're going to let them not come to work. But it's that there's some, understanding and where we can move forward, and what problem solving needs to look like to get that better performance. But if we have that shared goal and we understand what it is, then we can also say, from my perspective, it looks like this, and try to communicate it again, not by saying you're a bad person, or you're lazy, or you're not doing this right. But here's my perspective. What I'm looking at is the whole team's here and you're not here yet. And they get frustrated, and then they're not as receptive when you do show up, and things don't go as, whatever. But you can say your perspective. But again, without a lot of labels, a lot of damning words, So you might think about your vocabulary and how you present things, but you can clearly say what your perspective is too, so they can kind of see it through your eyes too, and where your frustrations come from. Because otherwise, they don't know either. They can't read your mind. They don't know what it is that you're picturing, and it really. But if you can say, what I notice is you do really well when you do this, you're much more likely to increase that behavior.
We're talking about one-on-one conversation. So how can you show up skillfully in a one-on-one conversation to positively influence, inspire, and motivate individuals in the face of challenging or even difficult feedback? And I'm curious of if there are more of these one-on-one conversations happening skillfully. What might that do for the overall system, and the system being the organization? What begins to start to cultivate or develop within a system if these type of isolated one-on-one conversations and interactions or collaborations are happening skillfully? Can you paint a picture of what might happen to the larger?
Well, when people are feeling listened to and respected in that way, guess they perform better, and everybody starts to perform better. And I think it influences. If they were treated kindly, they're more likely to treat their coworkers kindly, or have more curiosity, maybe approach things a little different next time in an interaction. So teams also, and when you can build a team where that everybody's treating each other more this way, and you can influence other people to have more curiosity, approach situations in a more safe way, then it exponentially starts to improve performance, right? Things really go differently. And where you can play to everybody's strengths and get them doing the part that they're really good at, and then go, wow, see, when you did that again, wow, that really worked. And And then they tend to get more positive feedback from their coworkers. And so everything kind of builds. Instead of saying, you know, this person complained about you and that person complained about you, you know what that builds? You know, there's going to be a lot of resentment and a lot of backstabbing and a lot of, you know, problems. And you want to create the opposite, this sort of synergy where everybody's playing together. And you know, you've done a team sport. It really matters whether the team is clicking. It's not just one person excelling. I mean, that helps, sure. But it's when you could, when that person's motivating other people and using them for their strengths, then you, that's when you really get something fantastic happening.
Absolutely. And I find, you know, obviously the, it's not the strive for perfection here, because we are all human. We're all going to experience emotion. We will all have triggers at one point or another. And they're on this conversation of safety and building trust and building rapport through this kind of consistency of regulated emotion and awareness of self. There's a little bit of space that starts to form, right? And so, you know, Lisa, if you and I were in an organization, we're working together and, you know, we have experienced challenges, difficult times that we've worked through skillfully. We've, you know, been kind of steady drumbeats on stabilizing, getting work done and working well together. But maybe I come in and I have something at home that's really got me elevated before I even walked into work. Uh-huh. And we hit a challenge and all of a sudden I am in my trigger, or I'm, you know, my mind is flipped. I'm operating in a way that's not as normal or as my consistent behavior has been in the past. There might be, as long as the damage is not so large or so directed, you know, that there is some space for us to be human. There's space for us to have that moment where we're in maybe a guilt or shame cloud, or if we're angry or frustrated or sad, or there's some space to be human and be able to recover from that. And so I think it's not about being perfect and being aware of your own feelings and everyone's feelings all, you know, all forever, but it's how do you create enough safety, trust, and rapport that there's enough breath in the system to be able to manage the humanity and the reality of living in this life.
Right, right. Because it is, we're not, you know, we're all human and we're all going to have our frustrating moments, mm-hmm. you know, and it can be things that we have no control over, like, you know, a car spinning out of control in front of us on the freeway, you know, which scared us, you know. We didn't do anything wrong. In fact, we did something maybe even a little bit right, because we didn't get ourselves in the middle of it, because we were actually paying attention when we were driving. We're still going to come in an activated state. Our cortisol is up, you know, and we're going to be more reactive. So, you know, one little frustrating thing may make us very frustrated. And so when somebody's in that state, if we can notice it and go, oh, okay, it's not my coworker suddenly a terrible person, or my boss is suddenly a terrible person, but this is somebody who, this person's a little distressed. Maybe I could help them calm down a little bit, or smile at them, or, you know, make them feel a little bit safer here. Because whatever's going on, something's going on, and we may have no idea what it is. And again, that being curious instead of being perfect. So we don't have to understand what's going on all the time, but if we approach it with curiosity, you know, like, you know, are you okay? Something seems like it might be up today, but not what's wrong with you, you know, or what's going wrong for you. You sure came in with a chip on your shoulder this morning, you know, that will make us on the defensive, even if we did just have this potentially scary experience, you know, instead of, you know, let's take a breath here, or let's take a walk, or would you like a cup of coffee, or whatever we know works for that person. And we don't have to do it perfectly, and we don't have to do it right all the time. And one thing is we can repair when we have had a rupture. So we're going to have ruptures in our workplace relationships, because we're all human and we're not perfect. And so when we know that we've done something that we think might have upset somebody, we can set the stage for having a conversation about it. And to do that, it helps to sit down somewhere quiet, be on the same level where you can look eye to eye with the person and talk about, you know, I know this went sideways. I don't even know why, but let's try to figure it out. You know, first of all, what was your percent? What did you see? happen in that interaction. And listen, try to, you know, and pay attention to what signals we're giving. So what's our body posture? What's our intensity in our speech? How fast are we speaking? How loudly? You know, are we all like this, you know, tensed up? Or are we kind of relaxed? And, you know, I go, okay, something happened there. Something went sideways. But first we have to calm ourselves down. If we got triggered by it, we got to calm ourselves down. Take that walk, do the breathing, then invite the person in and say, okay, let's try to have this conversation. Let me see it from your perspective. And then, oh, okay, that's really interesting. My perspective was this. And trying to develop a shared understanding. And if we do that repair, that actually adds more resiliency to our relationships. You know, no relationships is everybody perfect all the time. It just doesn't happen. You know, and maybe they didn't get enough sleep, or maybe they got too much sleep, or maybe they got, I don't know, who knows, you know, whatever it is. But if we can do that repair, you know, and that's true for parents as well as for bosses, that, you know, no parent's perfect either. They have their moments, but if they can repair, if they can come back to us and have that kind of conversation, wow, that builds a lot of resilience in kids. Builds a lot of resilience in our romantic relationships. It builds a lot of resilience in the workplace, because we have to have resilience because we need to recover from things. You know, if business just went smoothly all the time, you know, and people always came as their best self and always did, you know, things perfectly, you know, that's some other world, right? You know, that's some fantasy. Reality is we're all human. We all have a lot of stuff going on. And, you know, even at our best, we're going to miss sometimes. And it doesn't have to be perfect. You know, being a good enough parent is getting it right about 30% of the time. That's not perfect. Being a good boss doesn't mean you have to get it right all the time. But the more you can do that, and the more you can repair when there's been a rupture, and when somebody's shut down or withdrawing or pulling away, you know there's been a rupture. And, you know, maybe this person's essential to your organization, or they have a skill that they're bringing to the table that you really want, but you can see they're disengaging, you know, rather than just panic, you might want to try to take a minute and try to figure out what happened. Was there some incident? Was there something that made them feel threatened? Maybe they heard that there was going to be some layoffs and they thought it was going to be them. Maybe it had nothing to do with them, but whatever. You know, trying to see what their perspective is and what happened for them to get so disengaged. And it may be that it's something at work, and it may be something that has nothing to do with work. You know, and that's okay too.
I think in everything that we've touched on in this conversation, from one, identifying your own emotions and naming it and taking a moment to allow to feel the weather that's moving over or through you and allowing it to pass, and just being aware of, okay, when am I triggered? Then how is it to show up skillfully in a one-on-one conversation and be able to inspire and motivate and allow space for the individual to be present in that conversation, even if difficult information is being communicated. And then we're talking a bit about what is it to recognize and notice if there's been a rupture in the one-on-one relationship or communication, and knowing that we have and relying on skills and abilities to repair. And I think what was fascinating by an earlier discussion we've had, we talked about trauma being unresolved, but can still be resolved. We can experience ruptures and then we can resolve the ruptures, and how that actually builds resiliency and strength in the relationship, even more so than just going about your time having positive experiences of even managing challenges together skillfully. And I think in everything that you're communicating, as I think back in my position of being an executive performance coach, it all benefits effectiveness, efficiencies, performances, pacing in which you're working in your organization, because the more that we can identify and move through, the more that we can acknowledge ruptures and repair, the more rapport and trust and safety we have in the system, that there's a little bit of space for breath and creativity and recovery and curiosity that it all allows your system to kind of operate and hum at a higher level than what happens if there is resentment and or lack of awareness or shame or guilt or anger or sadness. When that's all kind of bogged into the system, it weighs down on it. And what I'm even hearing is if the mind is in places like fear, anxiety, shame, guilt, is that it's not actually receiving information. It's not able to retain. It's not able to, you know, take on new skills, to be able to remember new skills, to be able to articulate clearly, to be able to have decision-making skills that are in a clear and kind of sharp way in the mind, that all that tends to shut down. So what happens when we are self-responsible for our emotional experience, and that we are doing the kind of emotional gym work so that we can show up and be resilient and really consistent in our behaviors? And then what is the impact to actually regulate others and interact with others in a skillful way, and be that responsible, but then accountable to be able to come back and restore in human moments? And again, I think what's just so fun and fascinating about this conversation, Lisa, is that it's all connected to our highest performance, our best performance, and our whole self, our whole selves being able to come forward and perform at our best abilities.
Right, right. And I think, you know, when things get too rigid or too chaotic, you know, then we're not performing at our best, you know? And it's in that flow. We want to be the river. If you're two banks, you know, rigidity and chaos, you want to be in that flow in the middle, and you want your organization to be in that flow. And it doesn't mean it's not bouncing on one bank or another here or there, but it can be moving forward. And like you said, it builds resiliency. When we have that skill to help people downregulate when they're triggered, when we learn how to downregulate ourselves, when we need to, you know, our mind functions much better. You know, all these integrated circuits can have their differentiated functions, but link and work well together. And we want our companies to, you know, each individual to be differentiated, but also be able to link and work well together, you know, whether that's departments or individuals or whatever it might be.
And I love that you brought up the two banks of rigidity and chaos, and in the middle is the river of flow. And oftentimes we coach to say, if you're finding yourself in the bank of rigidity, add a little bit of freedom over there. If you're finding yourself on the bank of chaos, add a bit of structure, and it allows you to come back into that river of flow. And we are all about flow and peak performance. And so ensuring we're not getting snagged or caught up or stuck on those banks is super important to find our way back. Thank you so much for the insight that you've shared on today's episode. We look forward to having you back and continuing the conversation. And this is just going to be an incredible knowledge to share with our listeners. So thank you, Lisa.
Oh, you're so welcome. It's always a pleasure to talk to you.
If you enjoyed today's episode, please take the opportunity to share with a friend, follow Mindful Warrior Radio, and leave a review. To learn more about Mindful Warrior and Mindful Warrior Radio, please follow us on Instagram at The Real Mindful Warrior and check out our website at www.mindfulwarrior.com. I look forward to our next discussion here on Mindful Warrior Radio.